major support for Louisiana Eats on WWNO provided by Zatarain's, proud producers of authentic New Orleans-style cuisine. Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889.
From WWNO New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. Historically, the carnival season was the Catholics' pre-Lenten goodbye to meat. That's why the bouffe gras, or fat bull, always precedes Rex, the king of carnival, in the annual procession. In honor of that tradition, this week's Louisiana Eats is a true carnivore's delight. First, we'll visit with the crew from Cleaver & Company, a true snout-to-tail butcher shop. Then, historian Dr. Lawrence Powell shares the story of the 1873 U.S. slaughterhouse cases, a Supreme Court case that had as much to do with post-Reconstruction segregation as it did with slaughterhouses. We've got a meaty tale or two for you on this week's Louisiana Eats. Post-World War II boon in supermarkets brought about the demise of the neighborhood butcher, that kindly corner meat market where a smiling man knew just how thick to cut your steak and guaranteed that your Sunday roast would be fork tender. But everything old is new again at the New Orleans-based, locally sourced, whole animal Cleaver & Company. This visionary new business opened in late 2012 by Seth Hampstead and Simone Reggie and their resident butcher, who is none other than Chris Dahl, who's worked his magic previously at Koshan Butcher, Ancora, and Amano. So welcome, y'all. What a thrill to have you here.
Thank you.
So, Seth and Simone, give us the genesis of this amazing new but actually very old-fashioned style of business.
I mean, I've been thinking about this for several years, probably about 5 or 6 years now. I started wanting a higher service meat counter at a supermarket or a butcher shop. I was in Chicago at the time, and there were a couple scattered around the city there, but nothing quite, you know, what I was looking for. It was all commercially produced. It was not quite full service. And I was going to the farmer's market, seeing the high-quality product that all the farmers were producing, but they really had no access outside of the, you know, once-weekly farmer's market. And, you know, you couldn't get custom cuts from them. So it's like you had somebody producing a high-quality product without an access to the market. In the meantime, I was, you know, thinking about opening this in Chicago and realized, why am I doing this in Chicago when I want to move back to New Orleans?
So you're not from here?
No, I'm originally from West Virginia. I moved to New Orleans in the 90s to go to Tulane for undergrad. And then I originally was studying as a chemist and went to University of Chicago to get my PhD in chemistry. About a couple years into that, I realized, well, I don't, you know, this isn't really what I want to do anymore. So I worked as became an economic consultant in Chicago for about 8-9 years. So I decided to come back to New Orleans. I was getting my MBA at Tulane when I met Simone. And, you know, one of the parts about business education is learning your strengths and learning your weaknesses.
Yeah.
And I knew that my weakness was sales and marketing, and that was definitely what Simone had in spades. So we started working together probably a little over a year ago, and started kind of working out the kinks and getting all this running. I mean, I had the idea in Chicago. It was definitely a Chicago market when I started thinking about it there. And then when I started moving the concept down here, and when Simone and I started talking, we wanted to make it more of a Cajun-style meat market, bring in those traditions, because I think local traditions are very important, something that we need to preserve.
And you, Simone, are a Cajun girl from Lafayette. So
yes.
Sort of give me a little background on your piece of the puzzle and how you fit in here.
When you go to Lafayette, there is a butcher shop or meat market on every corner. I mean, it is nothing to go stop by someplace and get a Boudin stuffed chicken or a pre-marinated roast and stick it in the oven and it's done. Or stop at a store and pick up some Boudin and go. And I came here, and as I was living here, I realized everybody just goes to the grocery store and it's all prepackaged and there's none of that interaction that you have with people. And so that's when I told Seth, you know, I was really interested in his concept. I was like, yes, let's do this. And then when I worked for John Besh last summer, I really got close to the farmers. realizing that they didn't have an outlet, like Seth was talking about, to get their product out in the market. And so I was like, let's do this. I would love to be a part of this and help establish a relationship with the farmers and be able to bring in the whole animal and break it down and sell it. And it's like a giant puzzle. I keep saying that, but it's really what it's like, because you have to figure out like how to piece everything together so that there's as little waste as possible.
Chris, where did you come into the picture?
They needed somebody to cut meat. So that's what I do.
And tell me a little bit about how you ended up being sort of the guru butcher that you are today.
My family has always been in cattle and horses since the 1800s when they came over from Europe. We came here, sold horses to the cavalry. In one way or another, my family's been involved with horses or cattle, so I grew up with that. And
you grew up in Lafayette?
I was born in Lafayette. I lived north of there on a plantation in Washington, raised racehorses for Evangeline Downs and Delta Downs. Lived there for a while, and then I lived up north in Ruston.
And where did the whole butchery element come into your life?
My grandfather was a hunting guide, and he pretty much raised me from the time I was 3 years old. So he would take me out when I was really small. He gave me a .22, and we would go rabbit hunting. And whatever we shot, it was gutted right there, and that was going to be dinner in a day or two. So, you know, he gave me a knife and a rifle when I was like five.
So your first butchery work was actually field dressing.
Right.
That's so cool. Well, another thing that I'm really curious about is your slaughterhouses. Now, I prefer the word abattoir. I think that that's such a pretty word.
Much more romantic.
Yeah. I know you are very particular that all of your meat is coming from within a 200-mile radius. So what's the deal with the slaughterhouses or the abattoirs? Are you able to cross state lines? What's the deal with that?
So all of our processing facilities, or abattoirs, are state inspected, the ones in Louisiana, and we cannot cross state lines with those. We predominantly go through Unisuperette and Rauschers out in Plaquemine. But we do have a couple vendors who come from Mississippi, and they have to go through a USDA slaughterhouse. It's around Summit, Mississippi, and therefore they can cross state lines with it.
It's so interesting.
Yeah, there's a lot of old rules.
a lot of red tape and rules. Yeah. Well, that's a good thing, actually, in some ways. It just makes it hard for this new model of business to roll easily. What sort of research did you all do when you were setting out to do this? And were there other businesses in the U.S. that inspired you?
Well, there are several that are doing this throughout the country. Seth went to Chicago and New York to visit butcher shops there, and I went to San Francisco and just kind of visited with these guys and asked the logistics, like, what are we not thinking of? And we've established relationships with these butcher shops now so that when we hit a bump in the road, it's nothing for me to call. You know, there's a butcher shop in L.A. I called the other day, Lindy and Grundy, that are doing the same thing. And I was like, hi, I just opened a butcher shop. And they were just super helpful, and I think they just really want this cause to work. And then Seth has a friend in Chicago who opened Butcher and Larder, which is also a similar concept. And so we've kind of, there's this close-knit community of butchers throughout the country, but nobody was doing it here yet. And so that's where we came in. But we spent our summer visiting all of our farmers, every single farm we've been to.
Well, that's one of the things that I really want to discuss is who are your farmers? Who are your ranchers? And how did you find them? And how did you get to know them? And tell me a little bit about who you're working with.
Well, for cattle, we're working with Gonsalon Land and Cattle out of New Iberia. At the beginning of the summer, we were going around kind of basically an interview process of going to these farmers and visiting them and making sure that they had our standards, like beef, for example, grass-fed, grass-finished. And when I met Shannon Gonsalon, it was just like, I mean, he's like a brother I never had. We talk all the time, and he really takes care of his animals. For example, they bring the cows to the slaughterhouse or to the processing facility in the middle of the night when it's dark, and they're the first ones that are processed so that they undergo the least amount of stress. Mm-hmm. And so it's like little things like that that they really care about, the big picture. And then for hogs, we're going through Hollywood Livestock, which is in Zachary, Louisiana. A guy named Garrison Landry, super nice guy. He was in school and realized that there was a need for this. And so he and his dad started this farm, and he's doing great.
Are any of your selections breed specific?
Yes. For hogs, they are. Yes. And our cattle, too.
And the chickens.
Yeah, yes.
So what are
so yes they are.
Okay, so name drop the breeds. What are they?
So for our cattle is Brangus. It's Brahma and Angus mix. And then for our hogs primarily we have Tamworth, Large Black, Berkshire and Durocs. And we also go with Chappapila Farms, which has ducks that they're providing. You know, you'll see their name on several restaurants. And then they also have Berkshire Duroc hogs.
Now, why was this locavore concept so important to you all?
Well, it's the idea of food miles, of how long it takes your food to travel. We have the ability to support Louisiana with Louisiana farms. Why aren't we doing that? Why are we sending all of our produce money to California, Mexico, Venezuela, when we could be keeping it as local as possible and turning the money over locally?
I've got a man in a market. He sure can cut my meat.
We've been talking with the crew from Cleaver & Company, a new snout-to-tail butcher operation in New Orleans. When we come back from a short break, we'll explore the unusual parts and pieces that come when purchasing a whole animal for butchery.
And if you let him cut your pork chop, girl, it will give you a treat.
I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. Now, we return to our conversation with the crew from Cleaver & Company to hear how a butcher shop deals with all the organ meat that comes when purchasing a whole animal. When I first visited the shop, one of the things that just totally blew me out were the unusual things that I'd never seen anybody offer before, like spleen, okay? So how does that go from the abattoir to you? I always was under the impression that the slaughterhouses don't often like to give up the innards. So how's that going?
It depends on which parts, and Chris probably knows this better than I do, but I mean, there are certain parts that we almost never see.
But one thing is, since we're buying directly from the farmers, we're buying the whole animal. So it's not up to the slaughterhouse. If they don't want to give us the pork liver, they kind of have to. We bought the animal, and so we're not buying it from the slaughterhouse. We're buying it from the farmer itself.
The inspectors that are inspecting the slaughter can have things thrown out if they don't, it doesn't look good to them. And usually, I mean, it seems like no one was interested in all of these parts before, so they're just throwing them out. And as we started working with Eunice Moore and saying, like, no, we really want these parts, the inspector's been making more of an effort to allow more stuff through for us. We just got a call the other day for somebody looking for a raw pancreas for her cat, because her cat has a pancreatitis, I believe, and is supposed to be eating 2 ounces of raw pancreas. And obviously, no one can do that for her. She called around a bunch of different places. We talked to our slaughterhouses and our vendors, and especially considering this is for a cat, not food, we think we're going to be able to provide it for her.
Oh, that is just so great. And when I saw, I hate to dwell on the spleen thing, but that was the one that really kind of bent my brain when I saw spleen. And so I have a really dear friend who lives in Vermont, and she's a research chef. And so I called her up immediately and said, okay, so what in the heck do you do with spleen? And she said, oh, spleen's really in now. You know, people are cooking it with beans. And so what do you know that people in, what are home cooks in New Orleans doing with a spleen? And what kind of reactions do you get from people who walk in and see things like that available?
Yeah. I mean, the only real spleen dish that I know of is a Sicilian sandwich made with spleen, but maybe Chris knows more than I do.
The use for spleen that I have is you can make fake bone marrow with that. You basically you grind it up as fine as you can get it and run it through a sieve, and then the liquid spleen can be seasoned up and refrigerated a lot like you would do a compound butter, so you can emulsify it, make it back into a warm butter texture, and then roll it up in plastic and refrigerate it, and it has a really similar taste to bone marrow.
Fascinating. So, Simone, I know you're at the front door, right there at the counter all day. What are some of the reactions you've been getting from people?
People are really interested. Like, they get really excited when they're like, oh, heart, I've been looking for beef heart and I didn't know where to find it. Or, you know, a lot of the organ meats people are getting really excited about. There's this one guy that comes in that buys pork heart all the time.
Yeah.
But, you know, at first we were kind of, you know, concern was that people are so used to going to the store and buying a ribeye or a tenderloin. So they come in, they're like, you're out of ribeye and you're out of tenderloin. But we have so many other options that we can offer them. Or they're like, what's a deckle, for example? And people have really responded to that. Like, I had a woman came in yesterday and was like, okay, what do I want for dinner? And so that's kind of fun because not only Chris, but Dave Barbo and Brandon Blackwell, our other two guys, they all have culinary backgrounds. So they can help out whoever comes in. If you need any advice or want to be put in a certain direction, they can all help you.
And you've got recipes on your website,
yes,
too. So
and we have an array of cookbooks, too,
great,
that are right there to
well, you know,
look through.
I have to say, it was just like kismet. The timing was so perfect when my Madame Begay book came back in print, that, you know, and we reissued that this fall, and it almost totally coincided with your opening. And I had spent the whole summer changing those old-fashioned recipes around and changing the lard to olive oil or vegetable oil. And before I taught that very first brunch class, I walked in the door and there was the lard that Madame Begay was constantly referring to. So that was really exciting. And then you all also have leaf lard, huh?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Explain what's so important about leaf lard.
Leaf lard is basically the shock absorber for the kidneys. So when whatever animal is alive and running around, internal organs are kind of just bouncing around off the rib cage and whatnot. So they need some protection. And that's basically what the leaf lard is, a shock absorber for the kidney. And there's good fat and there's bad fat. For instance, like back fat on pork. You see that a lot in recipes. And then there's also fat that would be down next to the leg, kind of ties into the belly where the skirt is. That fat has a lot of glands in it that's just not good eating. Mm-hmm. So that fat is great for rendering, basically. It's what lard would be. Cut it out, grind it, put it on a medium temperature overnight, render it out, run it through a chinois, and then you have really great cooking fat. Back fat, however, is a denser, firmer fat. Say you were making a sausage out of a pork leg, then that's really lean. Like, there's, if you think about the anatomy of the animal that you're using, the leg gets a lot of work, so there's not really a room for a bunch of fat in there. So if you're making a sausage out of a leg, then you want to boost the fat content of that. Then you would add back fat to that, and that will make your sausage more moist instead of having, like, dry, beaten,
yeah,
like, pencil erasers.
Seth, I was really surprised. Of the three, we have two Lafayette natives, and then we have the, how would you describe yourself?
I try not to.
Well, anyway, it was much to my surprise that I learned that you are the boudin-making fanatic. Now,
yeah,
explain your whole fascination with boudin-making and how you've been working on this recipe. What's going on?
Yeah,
with
so
that?
I had an ex-girlfriend from New Iberia. That's how all bad stories start. But she would bring back boudin every week from New Iberia, and we ate a lot of it in college. And then I moved to Chicago, and there is no boudin to be had. So I had to, from memory, basically come up with the right recipe for this boudin so I could mimic it at home. That's how kind of a lot of it got started.
Okay, so your first boudin was your Chicago boudin. Now,
yes.
How has it transformed, and where are you at with your boudin now?
Yeah, luckily I have much more access to pork liver now, so I don't have to substitute other animals for it. But we worked over the summer perfecting the recipe, and we thought we had it really close. We were doing drops around the city to various friends of the shop to get their feedback. Chris kind of gave us the idea to put it over the top of substituting our green peppers for poblanos. And it really gave a dimension that we were missing before. And I think also the brown rice has been a great improvement.
Where did you get that idea from, Chris?
It's just basic Trinity that goes into the boudin. But, you know, like I like bell peppers, but they're not really bringing too much to the game, honestly.
Yeah.
For some people, jalapenos, serranos is too much. So there's the poblano, which is like a good middle ground, brings a little bit more peppery flavor to your Trinity, I think. So that's how the poblano got in there.
And I imagine the brown rice is brown Louisiana rice.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
Of course. Well, Chris, I understand that you're teaching classes at Cleaver & Company, and I've heard that they sell out like boom. Tell me about the classes.
So we're going to do a hog class, a beef class, a knife skills class, and a lamb class. And basically what I'll do is the animal will come in that day, and then that night we have people come into the shop, and I show them basically how we break it down for the shop or how it would be broken down for restaurant use.
I really have to tell you that I know there's a lot of interest in this, but so many 21st century people are used to buying their meat on styrofoam, wrapped in plastic, and I even know a lot of silly people who are squeamish about touching meat. So I'm kind of blown away by this concept of a home cook wanting to break down like a whole hog.
Really, it's a common request at this shop. Actually, a lot of people come in and just roll in and specifically ask about the butchering classes. So, I mean, I'm one of those people that grew up and, like, not a lot of people my age even cook that much, you know? I mean, I grew up in the 70s and I'm used to seeing the styrofoam shrink wrap meat in the store. I don't know when it started, but there's this just giant gap where, like, my grandma, you could give her a bucket of grass and some hay and a chicken and it would be amazing. She'd figure out something to do with it. And then there's, you know, my age of people that they're cool with the shrink wrap stuff. I don't know how that happened, but with this shop specifically, I see a lot of people roll in and ask about the butcher classes, so I'm excited about that.
Is it equally divided, men and women? Is everybody interested?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's pretty much even across the board.
Well, this is one of the things I really admire you all for, because I think that in America, we have suffered from so much fear of food, you know, lately. Oh, you can't eat the organ meats. That's what's processing the toxins. And well, but if you know where they're coming from and you know what they're eating. So you all are making converts and you're just really changing the food scene. And I think that is so cool. And Simone, I understand that our mutual friend Kat Kinsman at CNN's Eatocracy made a pretty bold prediction after a recent visit to Cleaver & Company. What did she have to say?
Yes, I was pretty excited about that. So they asked Eater National who they thought up-and-coming chefs were and restaurants in the country to look out for, and she said that the concept of Cleaver & Co. and the local butcher shop is going to be coming back, which we think is great, and I think it should be. That's the way it should be.
I'm just so tempted to make that cutting edge joke, you know? So what comes next?
I was at the farmer's market this morning, and the Motes told me, she was like, so I think I'm going to get more chickens, so if you want to have eggs, because so many people ask for them.
Yeah.
But Chris is really expanding the sausages he can come up with. Like the other day I walked up to him, I was like, I would love some sort of sausage with fruit. I'm like, 3 hours later, he's like, okay, so there's this duck and blood orange and pecan sausage I just made. I'm like, how did you just come up with that? And so I think that's expanding. More restaurants are wanting to carry our products. So even those people that don't cook are still going to be able to try our products.
That's fantastic. Thank you all so much for coming to visit us on your day off. I really appreciate you making the time.
Well, thank you for having us.
Thanks, Bobby.
Simone Reggie, Seth Hampstead, and Chris Dahl of the Meat Eating Locavore's Delight, Cleaver & Company.
Please, my babe, don't give my Lord away. Please, my baby, don't give my Lord away.
New Orleans-born jazz great Wynton Marsalis and I share a deep and abiding love for gumbo. As cultural correspondent for CBS Sunday Morning, Wynton wanted to give the whole country a taste of the real thing on Super Bowl Sunday. He wrote an ode to gumbo, eloquently describing it as perfectly symbolic of New Orleans, something that is much of a cultural symbol of Louisiana as jazz music and lazy bayous. Wynton believes that if you ask anyone where to find the best gumbo, the answer invariably is at home. Imagine my surprise when I learned that the homemade gumbo he was searching for was the gumbo I make in my own kitchen. On the morning of the shoot, the CBS News crew pulled up with more lighting and video equipment than I thought could possibly squeeze into my kitchen. We agreed previously on okra gumbo and that the real stars of the show should be our prized Louisiana seafood, shrimp, crab, and oysters, all just fresh off the boat. The tall cameraman shot over my shoulder and into the pot as I cooked the roux to a rich chocolate brown, adding the onions before the bell pepper and celery, a technique that makes all the difference in the world. My stock, made simply by combining shrimp heads and peels with pairings from the seasoning vegetables, also fascinated the crew from New York. At the segment's conclusion, Wynton sat down with a bowl of my gumbo. He took a bite, and with a big grin on his face, he looked right into the camera and said, "Have mercy, Poppy." I think the gumbo hit the spot. In fact, he had a second bowl before it was all over. To share in our gumbo fun, tune in to CBS this Sunday morning, or look for our link online. I think the gumbo bowl is just the way to kick off this year's Super Bowl. And if it makes you hungry for gumbo, you'll find my recipe on our Louisiana Eats website. I'm Poppy Tooker, grateful to be Wynton's gumbo girl.
Gumbo, yeah, yeah, can't feel a thing. Where's your poudre de palapeng?
More than 50 years, Betty Fussell has been writing about Americans and their relationship with food. In Betty's world of food, she urges us to talk about it, think about it, cook it, and certainly eat it as it maintains our bodies and sustains our hearts. Betty's 11th and most recent book is Raising Steaks, The Life and Times of American Beef. Betty, welcome to New Orleans and welcome to Louisiana Eats.
Oh, Poppy, thank you. Nobody knows better than you that this is my favorite eating city in the entire country, and I call it Eat City USA.
So tell us, what prompted you to write Raising Steaks?
First of all, I love steak. Who doesn't? But more than that, it's really an icon of America because it's fast, it's mobile, it requires the least amount of cooking of any food. So it's as if it's a kind of slap in the face, none of that la-di-da, we're cowboys, we're on the range, we're eating steak. This is which makes it always special. It really is our kind of special, let's go out and have a really celebratory meal. But beyond that, I started from the base of corn because corn was iconic. And I didn't know it, but corn really built the civilizations of our hemisphere.
And you wrote a seminal book about corn. The Story of Corn, I believe, was the name of it. And you won the International Association of Cooking Professionals Jane Grigson Award for scholarship for that little book, didn't you?
Well, this was back in the days before there had been any single subject books. It was a book about food. And this was still, you know, we didn't do that in those days. They were mostly cookbooks. But I loved finding out and exploring how come corn was a staple. Well, I didn't even realize that it was born in Mexico and went north and went south. It's our grain, as wheat is European and rice is Asian. And it built the civilizations of this hemisphere. Olmec, Maya, Aztec, and eventually our entire agribusiness. I love that arc.
So once you made that whole corn connection, part of what you discovered about the prairies, as I understand it, had to do with the disappearance of the buffalo.
We had to get rid of the buffalo, said one of our generals, in order to get rid of the Indians. By the end of the 19th century, there was something like 200 buffalo left. We exterminated the buffalo so that the prairies were available. And after World War II, we had an excess of nitrogen from the explosives industry. And where's all that nitrogen going to have to go? Let's put it into fertilizer. The fertilizers go in the cornfield. We have a massive surplus of corn. Where's the corn going to go? Into livestock. Corn on the hoof. So suddenly, we have all of our livestock being fed in enormous feedlots on corn.
And that's just not the natural sort of thing to do, is it?
Well, maybe it's okay for pigs, it's okay for chickens, but you do that with ruminants, you do that with cows and with sheep, particularly cows who have four stomachs, four chambers designed for one purpose only, turning cellulose, turning grass into a digestible thing for them. If you change that and make your primary feed corn, high protein, you've wrecked their stomachs and you've created a great loss because the grass isn't being harvested that way. But it's been very ruinous, as we have increasingly come to know, both for the environment, for the animals, and for ourselves.
So in essence, what does the difference turn out on the plate between grass-fed and corn-fed beef?
I've done a beef tasting, and that's how to do it. Do it like a wine tasting. Take 12 kinds of beef and use a corn-fed, use different breeds and different pastures. It's going to be like butter. They're going to taste differently wherever they fed, and very much it depends on the breed. Now, Angus became the commodity breed because it puts on weight fastest in this method of intensive feeding. We're trying to get away from that. We're trying to get back to grass, and the flavor returns. The commodity beef guys will say, but you've also lost fat and all the flavors in the fat. Not true. The flavors in the muscle, fat simply conveys flavor. And you can always use a little more olive oil or a little more beef fat in cooking. But what you want is the flavor in the meat, just as you want the flavor in the wine.
There's also a huge difference with this whole system and what it's doing to our world, right?
Well, let's say it's an industrial chain that cannot sustain itself because there are so many things that are wrong with it. Common sense says this is not a good way to raise cattle. So we want to get back to some of the earlier forms of pasturages, back to some of the earlier breeds so that they're not all Angus. The major commodity beef is simply Angus, and not really full percentage Angus, but all it has to be is 51% Angus. Or as some guys say, you know, just as long as you have a black cow, we can call it Angus.
Well, Betty, thank you so much for joining us on Louisiana Eats.
Thank you for being here and staying just the way you are. May Louisiana always eat.
Scholar and author, Betty Fussell. Our carnivore exploration continues after the next short break with historian Dr. Lawrence Powell. We'll examine the motives behind the U.S. slaughterhouse case of 1873, the first time that the civil rights protection of the 14th Amendment was tested after the Civil War. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Markets. Louisiana Eats culinary heritage heroes are farmers, fishers, chefs, and food producers who bring an authentic taste of our state's heritage to the world's tables. This week's culinary heritage hero is a rancher who cares for some very special animals.
Well, the age of the cattle affects the flavor of the meat as well as the diet. These steers are older. Most of the commercial breeds are slaughtered under a year and a half. Here in the United States, my steers are 3, sometimes 4 years old, and they're feeding in the woods and in the creek swamps around home. They're feeding on a variety of plants that most other breeds of livestock could not or would not eat. It aids them in parasite resistance. They will eat certain plants that have known, like amphimentics, which helps rid them from internal parasites. So it makes a difference, the diet that they eat compared to the diet that most commercial cattle get, which is a grain-based diet.
Our hero is a mountain of a man, usually found wearing denim overalls and a typical wide-brimmed 10-gallon Stetson hat to shield him from the hot sun of the South. That backwoods appearance is a bit deceptive, though, as our culinary heritage hero holds a master's degree in history, and that's why he can so easily explain the story behind the original bloodlines of his old breed cattle.
The Piney Woods cattle are classed as critical with the American Livestock Breeds Conservancy, which means their numbers are less than 2,000. They were the predominant breed from the edge of South Carolina all the way into East Texas in times past, but due to modern farming practices, they have all but disappeared.
Having grown up in a farming community, our hero well knew the taste difference of his beef. It's just beefier. This flavor, often missing in industrial-raised cattle, and his desire to share it, is what inspired our hero to become a vendor at the Crescent City Farmers Market. Many local chefs grew to appreciate his delicious products and enjoyed visiting with the colorful character who delivered it to their kitchen door.
Since I have been coming to the Crescent City Farmers Market, I've kept all of my heifers back, which are the juvenile cows. They will in turn be bred. They will have calves, and they will have bull calves. And these calves, not all of them are necessary for the reproduction of the breed, because one bull can cover many cows. So these are made into steers. They're grown out, and then they're processed, and I bring them to market for all my good friends here in New Orleans to enjoy.
That's why rancher Justin Pitts is this week's Louisiana Eats Culinary Heritage Hero, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen. Congratulations, Justin. When it comes to beef, your Piney Woods cattle are real Louisiana Eats. Retired Tulane history professor Lawrence Powell is the author of 12 books, most recently The Accidental City, Improvising New Orleans. This acclaimed authority on the Crescent City's history recently introduced me to the story of the 1873 U.S. slaughterhouse cases, a complicated tale that I knew would be of interest to Louisiana Eats listeners everywhere. Dr. Powell, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
Thank you, Poppy. Fun to be here.
So take us back in time to mid-19th century New Orleans. What was life like then?
Well, it could be nasty, brutish, and short, because this was a necropolis of America, swept by yellow fever epidemics, cholera epidemics, which don't get as much play as a yellow fever, but they were every bit as lethal, usually associated with foul water.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a lot of foul water here.
Well, I was fascinated to learn that, I guess, pretty early on, they were somehow piping Mississippi River water into the city.
Yeah, that was part of the drinking water system. And the problem was, before 1869, is that a lot of the slaughterhouses were scattered all over the place, and mainly what we call uptown New Orleans. And there was a few that were concentrated at a place, it must be up in the Carrollton area, called Slaughterhouse Point.
Yeah, because Carrollton was a great farming community.
It was, was.
And so I understand at that point there were like 1,000 butchers slaughtering up to 300,000 animals a year?
That's correct. I mean, before there was, you know, the stockyards of Kansas City or Chicago, New Orleans was a big destination for Texas cattle drives. But, you know, the Spaniards in the colonial period consolidated the slaughtering over on the West Bank above New Orleans. Mm-hmm. But because it was such an inconvenience, these thousands of butchers managed to worm their way back across the river. And they had these slaughtering houses, abattoirs, and bone boiling establishments all over the place.
Bone boiling?
Yeah. I guess you take the you know, the skeletal remains of the cattle and the pigs and you boil them. For what purpose? I can't tell you now, but that was going on. And so they, you know, you'd have 300,000 of these animals who were offloaded at all these riverfront landings, driven through the streets past schools and hospitals and tenements, scaring the bejesus out of everyone, dropping dung everywhere, and into all these petty butcher shops where they were slaughtered by these burly butchers with hammers and saws and axes.
Oh, God. It sounds sort of unsavory, really.
Yeah. Well, it gets worse. I mean, they were then skinned, and then the carcasses were hung by hooks for days, unrefrigerated, track flies. And then they would just throw the offal, you know, the entrails, into the river, into the streets.
Into the streets,
into
too?
The streets. So I mean, the stench and the reek was ungodly. That's why every summer, people who had the means would clear out for the country or the Gulf Coast.
And that's why at every front door, there was a sweet olive tree, right?
That probably was. But I don't think it was any contest for the reek coming from these places.
Wow. So they're throwing all these remains into the river, and it's the river water that's being piped into the city. So somehow or another, the Louisiana legislature set out to protect the health of the citizenry, and they created the Crescent City Livestock Landing and Slaughterhouse Company. Explain how that was supposed to work.
Well, it's kind of complicated. It was an idea that was borrowed from Milwaukee and New York, Philadelphia, other northern cities. After the Civil War, there were these sanitary reforms because all these cities were facing the same problem. And they resorted to the same means to do so, creating almost, in this case, like a Storyville for butchers. They would consolidate the butchering in one area and hope to isolate it. And so the legislature granted a 25-year exclusive contract, a monopoly, to this corporation, which it also chartered, with the understanding that the city would concentrate and confine all of the slaughtering at a central livestock landing at the new Slaughterhouse Point in Algiers.
Okay, so just like the Spaniards thought was a good idea, it went back to the West Bank.
Right, it went back to the West Bank and into one point. And the company didn't do the butchering. They just controlled the stalls that they would rent out at a reasonable price. And they could not exclude any of the butchers from those stalls.
So how did the city's butchers react to this?
Well, they raised a stink.
Stink number two, it sounds like.
Yes, it was. What happened, it's an irony of history, and I think also a kind of cautionary tale on how politics can trump good public policy. Because, again, for decades, the middle classes, white middle classes and upper classes have been trying to get this mess cleaned up because it was an unholy and unhealthy situation. And the first folks who were able to do it was the biracial Reconstruction era legislature, which was then domiciled in New Orleans. They brought it back from Baton Rouge during the Civil War and Reconstruction era. And they thought by introducing this public health measure, in fact, the legislation was titled An Act to Promote the Public Health of the City of New Orleans. They thought by finally getting this measure through, they could prove they could govern effectively and win the plaudits of all these skeptics and these rejectionists, really, in the white community. Except it didn't happen that way. I think folks were more interested in pulling down Reconstruction than they were in restoring, you know, some sanitary sanity to the city.
Well, the Butchers responded by forming what in those days was often termed a benevolent association.
Right.
So how did a Butchers Benevolent Association operate?
Well, I think they came together for the purpose of bringing suit.
Uh-huh.
Because they didn't want to, you know, they felt their property rights and livelihood were being undermined by being forced to go over here and rent stalls from a monopoly. So it played into this anti-monopoly feeling as well. But the folks who were leading and really the brains behind the opposition came from a coterie of lawyers, white lawyers, one of them led by a former U.S. Supreme Court justice named John Campbell, who were doing everything they could to bring down Reconstruction by tying up the legislation from the early Reconstruction legislature in one lawsuit after another. And this was a perfect one for them.
Well, this case was filed, and it went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court?
It did. It's a landmark case because it's the first U.S. Supreme Court decision to interpret what the meaning of the 14th Amendment was. Up to the Civil War, in fact, some people say we had to fight a civil war to determine whether we are a unum or a pluribus. Mm. The Civil War determined we were a unum. And the 14th Amendment, in effect, nationalized citizenship rights, by incorporating the Bill of Rights as attributes of citizenship. Now, that was the understanding of the framers. But the justices, and here's where the irony came in, the justices, mainly the five Republicans who voted to uphold this act, ruled that there were two types of citizenship, national citizenship, which is really consisted of, you know, the right to get a passport or safety on the high seas, and state citizenship had all the other fundamental rights. And basically what they were saying, and this was sort of inadvertent, that state governments would be left with the responsibility for defending these more fundamental rights. And we know how that turned out, not very well.
Mm-hmm. And of course, those fundamental rights are what we look at today as civil rights. And I think that's when people look at the 14th Amendment, I think a lot of them regard this as an early attempt to identify and protect civil rights of former slaves.
It did, but they did it in a way that subverted and undermined those rights. That was the irony. Because this idea that states would be responsible for defending civil rights basically opened a wide door for a retreat from Reconstruction that culminated in the Plessy v. Ferguson decision.
Mm-hmm.
The
great segregation.
That's correct.
Yeah. So are there any long-lasting effects from this that we might be able to see today?
You mean from a public health or a...
From a public health and, yeah, that sort of thing.
Well, the parallel I see is that then as now, it was very much of a low-tax culture mentality. And you saw a willingness of people to sacrifice public health and good public policy for, you know, some ideological commitment to, you know, low taxes for the sake of low taxes.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I think it speaks to how race can warp and distort government.
Well, I so appreciate you giving us this look back into time and teaching us all about the slaughterhouse rule.
Well, I hope I didn't give your audience indigestion.
No, all of this talk was delicious in one form or another. Thank you, Dr. Powell.
Thanks, Poppy.
Professor of History, Lawrence Powell. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at wwno.org. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support provided by Dickie Brennan and Company, Lights Egan Funeral Homes, and our media sponsor, Louisiana Kitchen and Culture Magazine. Theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes, produced at Piety Street Recording. Thanks to producer and sound engineer Thomas Walsh and our editor, Zoe Sullivan. I'm Poppy Tooker. We'll see you next time. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO.